I often think that Francis Harvey has done for Donegal and by extension for the west of Ireland what Norman McCaig did for Scotland and what R.S. Thomas did for Wales. He's accorded the landscapes and the people who live in them a dignity which had been stripped away as much almost by tourism as by earlier forms of invasion. This he has achieved with a naturalist's passion for precision and with an utter lack of sentimentality and yet with a very real human compassion.
In April 2005, I was stationed at the back of the stalls of the Town Hall Theatre in Galway, recording the readings at the Coote International Festival of Literature, a job I've done every year for many. Nobel laureates, Booker Prize winners, first-timers, old-timers, flashes in the pan, you name them, I've recorded them. On this particular day, an old gentleman in a tweed hat was introduced by the poet Moya Cannon.
Could I ask you to please welcome Francis Harvey?
Immediately striking was Harvey's custom of not introducing his poems.
Fern. Fern is a copycat arching its back under the half-hoops of the bramble. And later, a small child's minuscule bunch of bananas hand is the crozier of a bishop or a Viking longship dragon. The isosceles triangle of isosceles triangles. A measure of the wind's weight in calm weather is a fish picked clean to its green bone, a bonsai Christmas tree pressed paper thin, the groundling's answer to the freedom of the feather, the wing of a malingering plover, or a Gothic window grill of rusted metal is osteoporosis of the bracken, whose boneyards I crackle through and whose ghosts begin to haunt window panes in the first hard frosts of late autumn. The wheelwright and the boy. Even then, I thought of him as Joseph the worker, ankle deep in shavings of oak and ash, as though he'd been snipping curls from blonde heads of crepitant hair all day long. And this was a barber's shop. I saw the shape of the fellows in his stoop at the bench. Knots in the wood when effort made the veins in his hands bunch and stand out. I was a cross he had to bear, always touching things and asking questions about the icons of the maker. Spokeshaves, awls, planes, gouges, chisels, saws, all those names for the mystery of love and how it works, even when it's working against the grain.
Two poems in and I was already firmly hooked. Afterwards, I got his books, In the Light on the Stones and The Rainmakers, both published by Gallery Press, and The Boa Island Janus, Making Space and Collected Poems, published by Dedalus Press. These books were full of gems. But who was this Francis Harvey? He seemed like a national treasure in hiding. Later I asked Moya Cannon herself.
The first poem I ever read by him was The Death of Thady, which is actually the opening poem in his first collection, In the Light of the Stones. And he says, he could not tell you why he loves a place so much and loves a word that he would never use. I was absolutely blown away by those lines because I knew people like that. People who would never talk with any degree of sentimentality about the place in which they live. And yet they're utterly part, and it's part of their nervous system. They're part of its nervous system. And I was blown away by the way in which he rendered them with such truth and such lyricism. And he doesn't fudge anything. I mean, he is very clear about the hardship of these people's lives as well, as in The Deaf Woman in the Glen, you know, where she's locked in this landscape's fierce embrace as the badger is, whose unappeasable jaws only death unlocks from the throat of rabbit or rat.
Sheepmen. The dog noses a steaming bag lumped like an afterbirth at the open door. Two kittens eye the dance macabre of a leaf impaled on a thorn. And the sky is wet whitewash. God knows when it will dry. What scarecrow's that an insidious wind has stretched out on the broad of its back in the furrowed reaches of the big brass bed? Whose claws are those endlessly fondling the folds of the bedclothes with a passion never lavished on human flesh and bone? Whose eyes are those that keep turning away from the sparse light outside to the sparser light within? Owen McSharry of Creve is on his rack. Today he waits for the priest to come creaking up the narrow stairs past the hired woman and the Sacred Heart picture on the wall with the body of Christ in a box. A sheepman like himself, and the only one he'd trust to rid him of this thing stuck like a whinbush in the gap of his throat.
In 2011, I chanced my arm and called to Harvey's house. It was clear from my welcome that a man with a mic was a rare enough species of guest. So we broke the ice by going for a stroll in the foothills of his beloved Bluestack Mountains.
Ah, it's lovely here. I haven't been out here for ages. I love this now. And the silence. Well, I was always a reader, and for a period in Enniskillen, my mother kept a boarding house. She was hard up. And there was a man staying in the house. He had bought a whole set of Dickens. And I read every one of Dickens now. I think I must have been 13 or 14. And then there was a great library, the Carnegie Library. And then I discovered that English magazine, The Statesman, to which I subscribed for, I suppose, 40 years. No, you go ahead. Because I'll be slower on the stairs than you. It's a bit of a mess, you know. So I would have written most of it any time. It'd be in that chair I'd be sitting, you know. The typewriter was only used for the final draft. I came late to poetry, you know. I used to write radio plays and short stories. I switched to what happened. There was a play going ready to go on in the Olympia in Dublin. It was in rehearsal for a couple of weeks, I think. They suddenly said it was too short, you know. The story I heard was really that they got cold feet. It was a different Ireland then, you know. It was a very, very anti-clerical play, you know. I think it was the play I wrote about whether to save the mother or the child, you know, Catholic theology. So it was never produced. And I switched then. I began to write poetry. You see, I started off, the first poem I wrote, there was a weekly Daily Independent, and they published a poem every week. Paddy Kavanagh had his first poem published there, and that's where my first poem was published. I'd say I was a teenager, 18 or 19, yeah. I always remember a line that, potatoes clothed in rich brown clogging clay. See, I was living on a farm then, you know.
One of his great gifts is description, especially landscape description, or description of an object.
This is Michael Cody, poet and scribe of Carrick on Shore.
It's a particular gift of his, I think, to find ways of doing that without just being mere physical description.
Herland. Herland was assembled out of bits and scraps, not made. Like one of those early flying machines held together with glue and twine. His undercarriage is an afterthought, sticking out behind. He is all wings and no fuselage, and probably hollow inside. Finn could have blown him off the palm of his hand. He creaks into flight. The wind buffets him, gives him a bumpy ride. It seems he must somehow end up in a twisted heap of canvas and struts on the mountainside. But no, he tacks into weathers with a prow that rises and falls in the swell. The ghost of the pterodactyl haunts him in every cell. He alights, furls his wings like a wet umbrella, settles, wrapped and murderous, drying out in the wind and sun on the edge of a tarn, or hunched over a pool in the burn, pretending he's a blind, one-legged beggar man or a mystic communing with God. Too late for the fish or frog when it realizes he's not an old cod. Heron invented slow motion long before the movies came, but allows himself the lightning of his pickaxe for the killing game. Heron's the icon of the silences beyond the last tongues of land, where the islands float and quiver like mirages in the light. He's the hermit who daily petrifies himself in the reeds of the penitential lake. The logo of the lonely places past the last sheep and the last house. The El Greco or Modigliani doodle in a remote corner of the evening sky where the newsprint of distant waders swims before the eye. Heron's that sudden outlandish screech you hear at midnight in the water meadows as he changes into the wrong gear.
It's an amazing poem. You know, it's so true, so accurate, so well observed. And I'd like to point out how accessible it is, which is not to say that it's simple or simplistic, but the fact that you can enter it, you can visualize it and recognize things in it and bring your own imagination into the discourse between yourself and the poem, so to speak. That's what I mean by accessible.
Blessings. Yesterday, for some reason I couldn't understand, I suddenly felt starved of trees and had to make tracks towards the beaches of Loch Esk to set my heart at ease and stand there slowly adjusting myself to the overwhelming presence of all those trees.
It was like coming back among people again after living for ages alone. And as I reached out and laid my right hand in blessing on the trunk of a beech that had the solidity but not the coldness of stone, I knew it for the living thing it was under the palm of my hand, as surely as I know the living sensuousness of flesh and bone. And my blessing was returned 100-fold before it was time for me to go home. Jeez, he nearly got all off in one sentence there. He did it in two.
Fellow scribbler and librarian Tom French is also a fan.
There's a lovely confusion there between trees and people, like, isn't there? To be amongst the trees was like coming back amongst people again. It's a lovely simple conceit at the centre of the whole thing. Heaney's phrase is clean off the shovel. I mean, that seems as clean off the shovel as anything is ever likely to come. Like, so you'd love to see the work pages for that, to see how it had been scanning, panning out originally. All the sounds are working together, yeah. I suppose that was the blessing as well, that the whole thing kind of worked itself out so easily. But they are rare enough. I mean, a poem like that is a very rare thing. Like, you don't often come across them reading so well and being so clear and just being absolutely beautiful. Like,
Sometimes I've gone through maybe 20 pages trying to get a poem finished. You can go a certain distance, but you can't worry a poem into existence. You have to stop at some stage. The excitement for me is when I'm writing it. I'm not terribly interested in publication. When I'm writing it, when I say to myself, well, that's
That's I can't do anything more with that. It's finished. The excitement dies then. But I never say I'm finished with a poem till I've read it and read it and read it out loud. The sound the poem makes for me is of vital importance.
Oh, it's the important thing.
My final visit was to newly made Ireland Professor of Poetry, Paula Meehan.
I mean, even if you don't read the poem aloud, it's echoing inside the inner chamber, the inner sound box of your mind. For me, the poem happens as sound, maybe even to the extent that I would probably privilege sound over meaning or trust the sound to carry meaning. So to actually experience any poet's music, I would want to hear it, I would want to speak it, I would want to make my lips and my body make the same shapes as the poet made. So to bring the poem alive, I want to hear it out there aloud. And Francis's work is beautiful to read. I mean, it's a real pleasure what he makes you do with your lips and your throat and the resonating parts of your body. I mean, they're beautifully musical. You feel like these words in this order could never have happened before or since. I think the poet's voice is always the absolute authority while they're alive in some strange way, even though the poet's way of reading the poems and the relationship even with the breath patterning to the poems changes over time. So I think it is fantastic to hear the actual voice of the poet. This one, Icons, is in memory of his father. He used to lift me high above his head
like a football trophy until I was eye level with the cardboard print she'd nailed above the fanlight in the hall. And when I'd fall back into his arms, helpless with laughter, and feel the sandpaper of his beard against my cheek, I'd suddenly smell him and draw him deep down into my lungs until I was drugged with love for him and for the cobweb Christ I was too young to understand. My father must have thought such a strange thing there. As strange as those pictures of the king and queen I used to see in the houses of his people were to me. My father was a contractor. He built Enniskillen Town Hall, and he built, strangely enough, he was a Presbyterian. He built the Catholic Church. It was a huge Catholic church in Enniskillen. He used to do work on some of the big ascendancy houses around Enniskillen. I remember going out in the lorry with him, you know, or a van or something. I was 6 years of age when I've only half a dozen memories of him, really, you know. Cancer. It was what I expected it would be, but for the smells. The rankness took my breath away. They led me by the hand from cage to cage. A monkey yawned and ate its fleas. The reptiles slept, dreaming of sin and death. A baby cried. I saw the lions and the elephant and heard the parrots rage all through that afternoon and felt a vague, mysterious sense of something going on beyond what was going on here. A world I'd sometimes glimpsed when for no reason at all grown-ups would suddenly burst into tears or kiss or, like my parents now, constantly reach out to touch each other and touch me. My mother was a very reticent woman, but as far as I know, her father had a good big farm of land along the banks of the Erne at Ballyshannon. He also ran a wholesale wine and spirit business in the town. And as far as I know, he was born, you know, poor, small farmer. But he was a great judge of an animal. He could judge the weight of an animal by looking at it. And he did very well in the cattle trade. And he married into a family called Tuttle. And they were well-to-do Protestants with a big business in Ballyshannon. And one of them was a judge. Now, he moved up the ladder a lot when he married one of the Tuttles. And then he bought Earnview, the house on the far side of the river, where I spent a good bit of my childhood.
They say that a woman's crowning glory is her hair. And in her case, that was certainly true, because she had this magnificent head of long black hair that, when she unloosened it, fell almost to her waist, but which, as I remember her, she mostly wore in a bun spiked with hairpins on the nape of her neck. And in childhood, it appears, she used to wear it hung around her neck and shoulders in cascades that in time would grow as white as the cascades of the Donegal River beside which she used to play. But whatever way she wore it, whether loose or in a bun, I always knew that she was inordinately proud of her hair. And one of my most ineffaceable memories of her, and I have as many memories of her as there were once corncrakes in her father's meadow, or salmon in the river alongside which she played. One of my most ineffaceable memories of a woman who was born into a vanished world of horses and carts, jaunting cars, summer roads, and wayside flowers white with dust, is of the way she would, when she was preparing for bed, unpin her long black hair and brush it and comb it until it shone like patent leather. One summer's day, she and one of her sisters were playing on the riverbank close to a salmon pool where once, but no longer, you could hear on windless evenings anglers hit the hiss of their wet lines slicing the butter soft golden air. One fine summer's evening, it somehow happened that she overbalanced and fell into this deep pool and was in immediate danger of being carried away by the current, only for the fact that her sister, having failed to grasp some part of her body, an arm, a leg, anything, as she was going under, managed in a last, almost despairing effort to catch some strands of her hair and succeeded in pulling her towards the bank, and then dragging her out on the grass where she lay, panting, exhausted, like one of the salmon generations of anglers had landed in the same place. Was it any wonder then that she, who owed her life to her hair, would always cherish it with such a fierce passion, and would continue to brush it and comb it every night of her life until, in old age, she became incapable of even this labour of love? And was it any wonder that, as she lay on her deathbed, and those who were looking after her had unthinkingly cut her hair, and I was one day confronted with this white, cropped head on the pillow, was it any wonder that I instantly knew that in depriving her of her hair, they were depriving her of something which even the river had failed to do so many years ago? And, surely enough, this woman, who was my mother, and to whose hair, its length and its strength, I owe my very existence, died not long after that.
But my mother, as far as I could extract from her the facts, she ran away to marry my father. He disapproved of, I gather,
Grandfather Cassidy.
He disapproved of his own daughter marrying a Presbyterian in Enniskillen, although he had married a Protestant.
In any family, there's a certain amount of negotiating between two traditions. We've all been aware of that, the tradition of our mother's family, the tradition of our father's family. But in the case of Francis Harvey, this was just a great deal more marked by the sectarian tensions which would have manifested themselves right through his life. It must have been a very, very difficult time to grow up as the child of a mixed marriage.
Love letters. HMH. The mustard consonants stand to attention like soldiers on the page. No surrender to the insidious, mellifluous importunities of the songs the siren orchestrates out of A, E, I, O, U. From the seduction of vowels, Lord, deliver your consonants and know your own by the sound of their names. O'Shea, O'Flaherty, McHugh and McCool. Names that could hardly have been more than names to him, not people they'd ever invite to afternoon tea, until she came vowling like a swallow from the south and melted every consonant in his mouth.
HMH, of course, being his father's initials and somebody whom he really probably didn't remember very, very clearly. And he was trying to grope at an acquaintance with him. But that negotiating between two traditions, I think, is probably very important in shaping him as a poet, because you're always terribly aware of your step. That kind of standing back and watching is a marvellous training for any kind of an artist.
Bog speak. For centuries, I have been quaking under the weight of well-shod feet. None of them was capable of learning that whoever walks on me walks on water. If they put a foot wrong, they drowned in what only the woodcairn knew was bottomless, solid ground. In my fluid and devious conspiracies with land and water, I have swallowed stepping stones the way I have swallowed dolmens and crosses. I thrive on the liquid diet martyrdom has prescribed for the saint and the hunger striker, and carnivorous too, like my daughter, the sundew. I sometimes regurgitate the corpse of some informer I reluctantly ate. Now and then the mist lifts to reveal the substance of my fantasies dissolving in sunlight, but only for a moment. And soon I am fantasizing again. Enter me gently and never forget what my loneliness masks. All my dreams are wet, and I keep coming under the pressure of alien bodies I love to hate. Sometimes with the sun's help, I crack a dry joke. Mostly I've been going up in puffs of smoke. Bog man, bog bishop, bog job. I have a bad name, as many as there are different kinds of wet weather in the taxonomy of rain. I flow slow and run deep, the lie of the land. In summer you can hear me ticking over like a clucking hen sitting on the clutch of bombs history lays and hatred slowly hatches. The bog is speaking here, and the bog has emerged fairly recently in Irish consciousness as being one of our primary engines of assimilation and of history. 30 years ago, 40 years ago, until I suppose Seamus Heaney really took on that image and that idea of the bog assimilating everything. It's pretty new in our consciousness. And not only does Francis Harvey use it here, but he actually gives it a voice, a first-person voice.
The Scarecrow, in memory of Simon Weil. Sun, rain, snow, storm, the derision of crows, God letting the world be what the world is. The children of the children we fed on a diet of stones, with nothing to throw at me now but the stones of their hearts. Such weathers have reduced me to this, a clown's trousers and a clawhammer coat, my soul slowly beginning to leak into the bog hole at my feet. God knows when the bliss of all this affliction will end, and the wind finally strip me of my rags and lay me out on the ground in my shroud of mist. Then you will know who I am and why I wore the clothes of the creature called man. I was made in the shape of a cross.
There's such ease and grace in so many of the poems, but there is an uneasy strain, and I found it in that sequence, The Ghost in the Machine, those seven magnificent sonnets, where he remembers with a certain amount of affection his early life as an altar boy and in the traditional kind of Catholicism that he would have had and I would have probably smelt the end of as a child, the missions and the great oratory from the pulpit and the fear of God and the fear of the flesh and the kind of sexual confusion. I mean, I think of Gerard Manley Hopkins's sonnets. They're called the Terrible Sonnets because they deal with the soul on the edge of itself. So it was that echo of Hopkins that I found in those sonnets and the magnificent John Clare poem, I Am. It was that kind of end of Francis's work I started to look at, you know, and I find it has its clearest expression in those sonnets, The Ghost and the Machine. Metamorphosis. I helped to vest him in the sacristy, and now the metamorphosis complete. A bird of paradise had risen out of the ashes of a crow, and surely it was paradise he was catching glimpses of behind closed eyes as I watched him withdraw into the mystery of a world you cannot enter with the world in your heart. Hoc est enim corpus meum. He held Christ's body between forefinger and thumb, but I was eye level with two frayed black trouser ends and a pair of lumpish boots, and I could not stop thinking of the way the world is bread and wine and feet of clay. You see in that beautiful poem, it's the priest's dirty shoes he's down with, the feet of clay, and it's always going to be the feet of clay for Francis.
John Clare. I am eye level with harebells and bees on a swelling curve of the earth. The wind breathes on the nape of my neck. I exchange the integument of my body for the pelt of the grass. Beetles and ladybirds inhabit the interstices of my bones, explore the valves of my heart. I insert my fingers into the moist orifices of earth, bruise my lips on clay and stones. The swish of birds' wings brushes against my ears like the silken passage of girls in long dresses. I enter the secret places where worms turn the world on their shoulders and pass the earth through the alembic of their guts. In the labyrinth of the green forest, I find them. A hare's foot, horseshoes, a rainbow of lichen. Someone calls me. The keeper comes, trampling the light underfoot, speaking a familiar language I am trying to unlearn. His words clash with the pealing of birds, the tongued bells of flowers.
I have some valuable books, yeah, but when you're 87, you know, what's precious?
Ah, yes, quite. I've read most of the books in this now, I'd say. I don't go back a lot, you know, to old books. I go back to Auden and Thomas. Auden. I think the Auden one is in here. Yeah, I have a great admiration for Auden. I like this little one now. This is all I'll read. Epitaph on a tyrant. Perfection of a kind was what he was after. And the poetry he invented was easy to understand. He knew human folly like the back of his hand and was greatly interested in armies and fleets. When he laughed, respectable senators burst with laughter. And when he cried, the little children died in the streets. I love that one. I like the rhythm again, you know. It's very hard to explain, you know, the beat. There's so many poets now that write other poetry are like chunks of prose, you know. You'd never say that about Auden or Thomas. Oh, here's one that I like, Evans. Evans! Yes, many a time I came down his bare flight of stairs into the gaunt kitchen with its wood fire, where crickets sang, accompaniment to the black kettle's whine, and so into the cold dark to smother in the thick tide of night that drifted about the walls of his stark farm on the hill ridge. It was not the dark filling my eyes and mouth appalled me, not even the drip of rain like blood from the one tree weather tortured. It was the dark silting the veins of that sick man I left stranded upon the vast and lonely shore of his bleak bed. R.S. Thomas. He was a great poet. He was a clergyman in Wales, you know. He was an oddball, you know. If he saw a parishioner approaching in the distance, you know, he'd be out walking in the hills. He'd jump over the stone wall and hide behind it till they passed. Yeah, he was an extraordinary character, yeah. He was a loner, a bit like myself in a lot of ways, even though when I drank, I mixed a good bit. But when I wasn't drinking, I liked my own company. Oh, I used to drink a lot, you know, quite a lot. Drive a car too, and I shouldn't have been. If I hadn't been in that job, the bank, I could have been an alcoholic. You know, if I was my own master, you know what I mean? Didn't have to go in at 9 o'clock in the morning. I remember in Moville, the parish hall is called St. Eugene's, and I used to go to dances there, and the women would leave me in the middle of the floor, you know, because I had too much. I wouldn't go to a dance at all unless I was tanked up. Wouldn't have dreamed of going. Or I wouldn't talk to a woman, you know what I mean, unless I had a lot of drink taken. But I wasn't much of a dancer, no. At Ards. All day the pheasants were honking like vintage cars, and the cows cropped young grass with the sound of rending cloth. The ferns were uncurling their croziers under the candelabra of the chestnuts, and the hills were blue, blue as the pools of bluebells in the grass. There was a smell of crushed almonds in the airs eddying from the winds. And you were there with a flower in your hand, and I was with you. And I wanted to take your other hand, but the children were there as well, and the cows. I knew they would stare. I met her in a village called Mallantown, the most northerly town in Ireland. I met her there at a dance. An aunt of mine had given me the price of a Ford Anglia car, and I took down a crowd of fellows that I knew, the
drank at Cairn Dunna, you know, and we went and discovered that the guards were raiding us. You couldn't get into the pub, you know, it was latish. So I went, discovered there was a dance on, went to the dance, and she happened to be at it. I don't know, it mightn't have been love at first sight, but pretty quickly. Well, she's not interested in poetry, you know that. Oh, we've had our ups and downs, you know, but she's very good to me.
Song at the end of time. Let it never be said of me, as it was of others who sang, that they only sang of their love when what they loved was dead. So I set it down today on paper in black and white, while I am still alive, and though the scythe man is at the gate. This is the woman I chose, against the voices of doubt, to lay her head on the pillow beside mine in the marriage bed, and out of the clay of flesh and the confessional dark, nurture a flower, even if sometimes I teetered on the edge of an abyss before love's tether tightened again and drew me back to the strong-minded woman who mixed the earth I saw on graves into her laughter and song, shook affectation out of me like a dog shakes its wet coat, feared neither priest nor pope, took country and religion with more than a pinch of salt, and bore me the children whose children I hope will carry the seeds of our union into the hearts of the children of children yet to be born. I open my mouth and shout it so that everyone can hear. Love that will take on time, even edge it towards fear. Love is here for the woman whose virtues I sing, the woman who is my wife. I like heat, as you can see. I suffer from something. I've suffered for years from that, but no doctor could tell me what the reason was. I am very cold-blooded, in that sense. I remember I went to a house in Dublin. It was Patrick Boyle. I used to visit. I knew him very well. When I arrived up there, when both of us arrived, they had their central heating had failed. It was winter. And I took whiskey, and I got very cold in the house without heat, you know. And the whiskey made it worse, you know. I remember Agnes saying to me, God, she said, you're like a corpse. But I went to doctor, but I never got any satisfactory answer, you know. I'm still alive. I didn't think I'd make 87, you know. This is a poem in memory of my friend, the short story writer and novelist Patrick Boyle. In memory of Patrick Boyle, 1905-1982. It was snowing in Glenveagh the day you died. Moylenenov was white, and the red deer watched us through fluted curtains of flowered light. The torrents were writhing like serpents in the heather, and the waterfalls hung out of the sky like the entrails of clouds. The wind was skinning the boles of the birches and peeling the scabs of lichen from the scalps of the stones. And we were cold that day as we ate our brown bread and cheese under a dripping rhododendron, but not as cold as you were, Patrick Boyle, had we known it then, laid out on your bed on the far side of Ireland. The deer turned their beautiful buff-coloured rumps into the wind, and one stag with antlers twisting out of its head like a thorn bush out of a split crag paused for a moment to stare at us out of eyes as impenetrable
and mysterious as the wilderness in which it was bred. I remembered those eyes when they told me, Patrick Boyle, that you were dead, and how you looked at me that last time I saw you alive, with the eyes of a stag being hunted towards the ultimate wilderness for which we are all bred.
Well, death does preoccupy me, you know, and has for years and years. Oh, I give that a lot of thought. But, you know, it's such a savage thing. It's such a savage thing when there's a mother and two or three children and a father is suddenly snatched away, you know what I mean? And just like that. I've been an agnostic for years. I was a very devout Catholic. And then I began to read a lot. I then stopped practicing. But I can never shake the Catholic thing, you know, the baggage is there, you know. I find it very hard to believe in Orthodox Catholicism. There's umpteen things that really pull me up. We're told about a God of love who created the world. But leaving human beings out of it, he created these animals that were tearing each other apart. There wasn't much love there. I wouldn't dismiss it completely, no. I used to read quite a bit about Buddhism. I used to read Thomas Merton quite a lot. He became interested in Eastern religion, you know. But it's too late at 87 years of age to become a Buddhist. It's too late. Hail and farewell. The big bull calf, all sea legs after 9 months afloat, was in his element now, gorging himself less on milk than on mouthfuls of fresh air. Making a stir in the world he just entered, with something still a long way from a roar. But all I could think of was my mother's brother, setting sail alone on his voyage earlier that day. His face a Belson spectre of skin and bone, his body invisible in the folds of the bedclothes, and me listening to him grinding out the last sound he'd ever make in this world from the depths of his throat, like stone scraping the keel as Charon launched his boat.
And that's one sentence. He can make it look very easy. He can lay out a sonnet very handily on a page, and he has done it kind of endlessly very well. You'd hate to have acquired celebrity in the process of doing it, like, and he just gets to do it. You kind of envy him in the same way, like, I mean, he gets to just fire off the good ones and get left alone. He doesn't have to deal with the media. So he's left to himself. There's an awful lot to be said for being left to yourself. I don't think he's unknown, though, to anybody who ever tried to write a poem. Just as a kind of an exemplar of the craft, I think he is definitely that. He's as good as you come across.
I think the reason Francis Harvey's work is not by any means as well known as it deserves to be is due to his own personal reticence. He was very, very shy about giving readings, found it quite an ordeal, and wasn't given to self-promotion. I suspect that's really the main reason. But he didn't start to publish, of course, until he was 50. The Northern Troubles, they had erupted at that time. There was a whole school of wonderful poets from the north of Ireland. Perhaps his work wasn't seen as being political enough. Perhaps the work related to the landscape was regarded as old hat.
There's very little, actually, of the overtly urban in his work. Now, I don't believe in making a division between those things, urban and rural, anyway. But the reality of his work is that you don't find many city poems. It doesn't matter. But his own world that he moves in, he has an absolutely unflinching eye he brings to it. There's no sentimentality. There's no soft focus. You get this powerful sense of the real, the material, and what it may mean or seem to mean or be utterly mysterious about. But he doesn't sort of jump into abstractions. One of the Latin tags that I remember is from St. Augustine, nihil in intellectu quod non prius fuerit in sensu, meaning there's nothing in the intellect which didn't come through the senses. Everything comes to us through those portals. I mean, what is in our minds before that? I suppose we don't know, but that's deep water. That's a deep bog hole.
I think what happens with a body of work is that, especially a poet so involved with landscape and the ecologies of place, the terrain, if you like, there's a kind of sense that they're putting their entire topos into amber. You know, you could reconstruct his topos from the poems. You could repopulate Donegal with the species of birds, with the creatures, with the community, with the people. That's the great gift of a body of work, you know, that it's a whole world, it's a virtual world unto itself, coded in a song. And I mean, that's what Francis has given us, an exceptionally elegant, musical body of lore about his loved and much inhabited place. So listen, before
I take that microphone... I took my leave of Francis and thanked him for his time. It had been a privilege to record him.
Thank you very much. You're great to take an interest in an old fellow like me.
Viewing the ruins under creased tea-stained tissue paper skin, the veins on the backs of his hands surface like the gnarled roots of old trees. When he rises from a chair or climbs the stairs, he creaks and whistles like the timbers and rigging of a ship in a storm at sea. The child that he was is the ghost beginning to haunt the ruins he thinks is a man. I watch the old growing old by watching myself. Thank you very much.